Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. Earlier this year, the Biden administration made the controversial decision to withdraw U.S. military forces from Afghanistan by the 20th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. The pullout actually came ahead of that deadline in mid-August, and the results were dramatic. The militant Taliban movement, which had been gathering strength in preceding months, took advantage of the U.S. drawdown to sweep across the country. Over the course of 6 days, city after city fell under Taliban control, culminating in the group's takeover of the country's capital, Kabul. Since then, the Taliban has set about consolidating political power and reimposing its own draconian version of Islamic law throughout the country. It has done so despite warnings and entreaties from the international community, which has pleaded with the group to respect human rights and to practice good governance. Last week marked 100 days of Taliban rule, and the milestone is an opportune moment to take stock of the current state of play in Afghanistan, of what's changed, what hasn't, and why it still matters. To do that, I turn to Andres Ilves. Andres is a regional director at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty in Prague, where he oversees RFERL's language services for Iran, Afghanistan, and Northwest Pakistan. A journalist and researcher, he previously worked at the BBC as head of its Persian and Pashto services, and as a sought-after independent media consultant, speaker, and trainer. A veteran of U.S. broadcasting, he logged two previous tours with RFERL. From 1984 to 1989, he worked as a journalist and researcher with the first incarnation of Radio Free Afghanistan. He returned to RFERL in 2002 to relaunch the Afghan service after the attacks of September 11th. While there, he also served as the first director of Radio Farda, a key part of the U.S. government's outreach to the Iranian people. Andres, great to talk to you.
Great to be here.
All right, let's start at the beginning. The Biden administration justified its pullout from Afghanistan as being broadly consistent with the will of the American people. And in fact, the Trump administration had planned very much the same thing when it was in office. But the way in which the withdrawal was executed was enormously problematic, and it put Afghan allies of the United States at serious risk. I wanted to ask you about the fate of one group in particular, Afghan journalists. How are they faring under the new regime in Kabul? And what does the media environment in the country look like now?
Well, it's a very apt question because, of course, the media are how Afghans are going to find out what's happening in their own country. And of course, the media is how the world finds out what's going on in that country. Afghanistan has been in and out of the world's consciousness for quite some time now. And so, of course, for the world, Afghanistan in some ways has been rediscovered a number of times. It didn't get a lot of attention paid to it. And then there was the Soviet invasion and occupation and so on. And then it was very much in the forefront of people's awareness and consciousness. And at the time, there was a very controlled media environment. It was a typical occupied Soviet client state. And so there wasn't really a lot of freedom. Before that, though, there had been kind of a nascent free press. You know, Afghanistan had been a monarchy and had been a republic and so on. And so you had the beginnings of a thriving press. You have a number of newspapers that go back over a century and had been in existence and then shut down or renamed under different circumstances and different occupying regimes. But why this is important is that Afghanistan has always had some form of press that was vibrant and was really trying to perform the function of a press. And the doors slammed down on that when the Taliban took over the first time. And then there was this re-blossoming, this absolute boom in media outlet. By 2021, there were dozens of TV networks, probably 170 or more FM radio stations. Free press, when it comes to newspapers, is a bit problematic if you have a low level of literacy, but you really had a thriving press environment. Of course, it's a country that has been at war for a very long time and had been at war for the past 20 years. And that, of course, curtailed a lot of people's activities. And now, of course, you don't have a wartime situation. You have a situation of a closed media environment mandated from above. So what has happened is probably 70% of the media outlets in Afghanistan have been closed. What does that mean? They get shut down. Journalists are told not to come to work. Women journalists are definitely told not to come to work. people have fled, journalists have fled. We can identify 6 journalists at least who have been killed since the Taliban took over the whole country in the middle of August. But of course, we don't know the true figures. It's not a good situation. And I should add, the Taliban have now issued some edicts about how it's going to be to operate as media in the new Afghanistan since they've come to power. They announced that there are going to be new journalism rules in September after they've been in power for a month. They said that it's going to be forbidden to broadcast stories or publish stories that are contrary to Islam, insult national figures, was their terminology, or violate what they call privacy. And of course, one of the challenges in that is that vague terminology like that enables people, you know, authorities to pursue anybody that they want. Now, they've added on to that November 21st, so not that long ago, guidelines that further restrict the broadcasting of media that are, in their view, in contravention of Islamic values. Some of the edicts particularly target women, journalists, and media workers. It's very clear which direction is headed. An example of what this all means is that when the Taliban were taking over the country very rapidly in the weeks preceding August 15th, in Badakhshan province, there were 3 FMs that are very interesting to take as a kind of case study of what happened. One of them was simply shut down. One of them was basically told that they have to now broadcast the Taliban radio. And the third one was told you can keep operating, but the women aren't allowed to appear on air. And there's going to be basically, you can only broadcast content that we approve of and that meets their guidelines of their interpretation of Islam. And that kind of summarizes it. You're shut down, or you're going to have to become an organ of our broadcasting, or you're going to keep on air, but it's going to have to be under very strict guidelines.
So what does the Taliban's takeover look like more broadly from the ground? What's the state of play on the Afghan street in political terms and in sociocultural terms?
So I was talking to somebody recently who went to Afghanistan to do some reporting. And one of the things that most struck this person is simply that the picture on the street is so different because there are far fewer women. Obviously, the rules are changing. Obviously, the rules are going to be in accordance with restrictions, some of which are still being promulgated. But I think you can easily say that a lot of women, and that's 50% or more of the population, are simply not wanting to take any risks by going out into public. So that's issue number one. And of course, beyond that, there's simply the fact, practically speaking, that if so many women have been told that they can't go to work anymore or girls aren't going to school for the most part, then you're just not going to see women on the street. And I think that is probably the most compelling thing in terms of the visuals and so on. And in general, people are taking fewer risks. And, you know, it's some of the things that you would have predicted based on the previous experience of the Taliban in power. So you don't walk by a restaurant and hear music blaring from it. There's a wait and see attitude. And to a certain extent, of course, businesses are continuing to operate and so on. But it's getting harder. And some of it can be attributed to the fact that the Taliban are in power. So you have their ideology, part of which is to restrict the role of women in society. Part of it is simply the result of the world's wait and see attitude on what this is going to mean. And so there's a pulling back on Western aid. And that then, of course, has an effect on everyday life in Afghanistan as well. The banking situation needs to be sorted out. There's a very, shall we say, intermittent electricity supply. It's having an effect on people's daily lives. And people are, they don't know what any of this is going to mean. How is their life going to change?
Have these details leaked out into the broader media? Is the international community accurately and fully reporting on what's going on in Afghanistan today? And if it isn't, why isn't it?
Well, and that's a tough thing, of course, is that journalists are leaving, journalists have left. And so the question is, who's going to be reporting on any of this? How are you going to find out what's really going on in the country? I don't think that the world necessarily has an agenda about misreporting Afghanistan, but like with any situation where there's limited access to information, limited access to media, things can happen in the dark. And so then it's easy to focus on certain aspects that are more visible. The world focuses very much on the past 20 years, 9/11, post 9/11, the past two decades of Hamid Karzai and Ashraf Ghani and so on. It's really important to remember that much of the situation that Afghanistan is in now was caused by the Soviet Union. And what might seem like ancient history is actually something that is lived and relived in many ways by Afghans every day to this day. For all of the focus on the role of the West in Afghanistan post 9/11 and so on, it's important to remember that the Soviet Union was there. They invaded Christmas Day 1979 and left in February of 1989. The most conservative estimate of the number of people who were killed, Afghan civilians killed because of the Soviet occupation that took place during the 1980s, is 500,000 people. Some figures go up to 2 million. The casualties of the past 20 years pale in comparison to that. And why is that? Well, part of that is that the West and Western media were not able to get in there. Afghan media was controlled. And so the Soviet occupation and the things that happened during that time over that almost decade were done in the dark. And this is a really key thing for us now. Is what is going on in Afghanistan going to happen in the dark or not? Who is going to be in there doing the courageous reporting? Who is going to be taking those risks? Who is going to be getting those stories out?
To that point, the changes that you're describing have obviously impacted the way that US broadcasters do business in Afghanistan as well. What has the Taliban takeover meant for your agency, for RFERL, and for its programming?
Well, it's an interesting time for us. We had close to 90 journalists working on the ground in Afghanistan. We had a bureau, and I think I can say with pride that Radio Free Afghanistan, renowned locally as Radio Azadi, which is Radio Freedom, Radio Liberty, essentially almost has acted as a national broadcaster for the people of Afghanistan because our work was so much on the ground. We had so many local reporters who were able to report from provinces, not just the what's happening with the urban elite or press conferences or whatever, but really essential daily life stuff. Lots and lots of very colorful reporting in terms of whether it could be the prices of some commodities going up or profiling a woman who's working somewhere, you know, as a computer technician, or lots and lots of very compelling stories. And the fact of the matter is that many of those people are no longer able to work freely. The women certainly aren't able to. And it's been a real security situation for us. We are committed to reporting fairly, and we are committed to reporting exactly what happens on the ground. And we have not censored or changed our program one iota. And some of what affords us the freedom to do that is that we're based outside of Afghanistan. Our headquarters is in Prague, Czech Republic. So even when we had a functioning bureau and the people working on the ground, they still reported and sent their reports into Prague. So we don't feel under pressure to be reporting differently, and we wouldn't report differently because we're there to provide, you know, open and free information that people wouldn't normally have access to. But it's a tough time.
So what about new media? It seems to me that this is a big piece of the puzzle. And one of the most striking things that I observed in watching the Taliban's latest surge to power was just how much the group relied on social media and internet messaging, things that it had previously rejected. How did the group exploit these things to get its message out? What was the group saying to Afghans at the time? And what are they saying now? What are the messages they're sending?
That's a really key question. They became very adept at using social media. They were very clever in using different platforms for different audiences. So, for example, they use Twitter a lot in English to make statements to the West. So a lot of the softening of their tone, a lot of the kind of almost conciliatory sounding statements and profile that they were projecting was done on Twitter and done in English. Well, that, of course, is accessible to the world, and Twitter is a medium used by thinkers and thought leaders and media professionals and so on. But that, of course, is not the main platform for everybody. And in Afghanistan, social media grew in usage inside the country, but there the medium was primarily Facebook. And before they swept to power in August of this year, there was a lot of domestic information and misinformation being put out there. It was basically every time that they felt that they had a victory on the battleground or so on, that was communicated on Facebook. And so if you were an Afghan living somewhere inside the country wondering what's going on, you had very active social media presence on the part of the Taliban that let you know that they were coming. And with very adept use of it, the Taliban were very good at, you know, posting comments and replies and, for lack of a better word, trolling and so on. And especially as it was clear that they might come to power, then you had a lot of social media self-editing on the part of non-Taliban who were thinking, well, I shouldn't necessarily be saying this, or I shouldn't be posting this, or I shouldn't be revealing these personal details because this might, you know, redound not to my benefit if they come to power. There's even more self-editing since they came to power. So you're not going to be posting pictures of yourself playing an instrument or so on. And I think that that is one of the key differences now. One other note that's really important to stress about Afghanistan that I think passes a lot of people by is the demographic pyramid in Afghanistan is one of the most skewed in the world. The median age in Afghanistan is 18. So over half the country was born since 9/11. So this is a country where half the population is that young. What is their future? Where are they getting their information from? It's that, of course, remains to be seen. How are they going to be hearing about what's happening in their country? Are they going to be using social media? We don't frankly even know what access to social media or any form of medium is going to be like. Are there going to be stricter controls on access to the internet or social media? That, of course, remains to be seen.
So Afghanistan's transition back to Islamist rule has obviously been a huge blow to democratic institutions and democratic processes in the country. And that includes the media sector, which, as you pointed out, thrived in the two decades since the Taliban was last in power. Is there anything that can be done by the international community to preserve those gains with regard to media in particular, now that the Taliban is back?
I think it's really important that the outside world continue to do what it has been doing, and that is to report from inside Afghanistan as much as possible and to report about Afghanistan. And that is going to be a key question now, is to what extent are people outside Afghanistan going to be paying attention to what's happening inside Afghanistan if there aren't soldiers from their country who are fighting there and casualties and so on? Is the world going to care about Afghanistan? That is really a danger, because there was a lot of attention from the West when the Soviet Union was occupying the country. And then after February of 1989, when the last Soviet soldier crossed the bridge into the then Soviet Union, the attention that the world paid to Afghanistan plummeted, and it became this obscure, remote place that people didn't really pay attention to. And Afghanistan has both benefited from and suffered from the fact that it's essentially not even easily assigned into a particular part of the globe. It's not really South Asia. It's not really the Middle East. Arguably, it's Central Asia, but most of the Central Asian countries are the five former Soviet republics. It's kind of there in the middle. So that could either mean that it receives a lot of attention, or does it end up falling out of the world's focus? And then, of course, it stops being a story. And there's the danger that in the dark, when nobody's paying attention, not great things can happen. We just, I'd say, have to hope that the world is interested.
Final question. What are the biggest stories related to Afghanistan from your vantage point? What do global publics need to know about what's going on there and what the future holds?
I think it's important to note the youth of the population of Afghanistan. That's really something that doesn't immediately come to mind as a story, but it is going to have a role in where Afghanistan goes. You're going to have a lot of young people who are going to need jobs. Their minds are ready to receive new information and either buy into the new ideology and philosophy of the regime or not. But basically, you have a blank page, if you will, a whole new generation that's upcoming that anything could happen with or to. You know, it's not going to be that many years till they begin to wonder what role they have, what say they have in how their country is run, what's going to happen to 50% of those, which is, I mean, if you look at it in this way, if half the population is under 18, half of those are girls. So 25% of Afghanistan is girls who are between 0 and 18. That's a quarter of the population. How are they going to grow up? That's a really big story. What will it be like for a quarter of the population who will never have gone to school? They simply will not have had access to it. Not a day inside a schoolhouse with a teacher doing what teachers do, providing them the education that they need for the future. And that aside, knowing that the role models are only going to be women working at home and working in occupations that are approved of and permitted under this new regime. I think that's a key story, is the youth and of course girls. And I know that this is of course something that the world focuses on, but it's that next generation that really merits attention from the world, is what's that going to mean for the future of this country? The scramble by other actors, who's going to be taking up the vacuum? Afghanistan has been in the middle of the Cold War, in the middle of a different type of ideological war, if you will, in the past 20 years. Now what? Are other countries going to be coming in? To what extent is China going to be taking advantage of its proximity and its relationship to the Taliban? We need to be spending, as outside media, spending more time and working harder to look at what we might be missing. So how are we going to cover Afghanistan and uncover the stories that may be hidden? That's going to be a key challenge for all of us.
Andres, thanks so much for taking the time to chat.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And, as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.